So, if you are looking for Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, The Witness of the Human Body to God's Creative Genius, you've come to the right place. That's what this is. And it's a real joy to see so many familiar faces and so many new faces that I don't know yet. But because I see unfamiliar faces, I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Dr. John Scott. I am a medical doctor. I also have, in a former lifetime, I was a PhD. I still am technically a PhD, but and so I've had an opportunity over the years to study a lot of things about how the human body works, and both in medicine, which is more of what I do now, and even before that, different type of molecular biology things and virology and immunology things in the past. I haven't done those things for a long time. I used to also teach things as well at one of the local universities in my med school and whatnot, UCLA, even clinically after that. But it's been a really long time since I've thought about some of these basic science topics about the incredible wonder and glory of God in creation and in our own human bodies. So What I'm hoping to do this morning is to look at the very beginning, a few passages of scriptures that speak about how God has formed us. And one of the most famous passages is in Psalm 139. I'm sure you recognize that very easily from the title. But what I don't want to do is try to take you through the first year of medical school in like an hour and a half or an hour and 15 minutes. That's like impossible. So what I've chosen to do instead is to pick and choose certain things that illustrate the amazing complexity of the human body and human cells, tissues, organs, and how they all work together in an amazing way to keep us all alive for a lifetime. And, you know, relatively healthy. As we age, things start to happen somewhat. But in any case, that's kind of the goal for today. And so basically what I do here, I'm a lay elder, and so I work with student ministries, with young single adults, with missionaries, and with the medical ministry here at church. So that's kind of what I do. So basically what we want to do is ultimately take home with us a greater appreciation of worship to our great God and his amazing, brilliant, incomparable brilliance and a creative diversity of his, the creation, not only of all of animals and plants and everything that he's created in creation, but particularly focusing on human beings today. So even the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, talking about spiritual gifts, calls upon the body as a metaphor for the spiritual body of Christ. And you guys all know that passage that, you know, he says, because an ear isn't in an eye, it has less glory, because it's not a hand, it's a hand, not a foot, it has more glory in the body, that everything is necessary working together in infinite detail within the church, that everyone is necessary and all their spiritual gifts are necessary for the healthy functioning of the church, the same it is with the human body, that every system, cell, tissue, organ all work together to keep us alive and healthy for a lifetime. So one of the things I'm going to do today is, this is a very visual presentation. So I have lots of slides. I don't want you to get lost in the slides. They're just to illustrate points. It's kind of like what I do in my medical practice. And so I'm going to invite you into my exam room. And in my exam room, there is an exam table, and it has paper on it that you lay on for your exam or whatever. And a lot of times what I will do is, rather than explaining something to my patient, I pull out a pen and I start diagramming whatever it is I'm speaking about to them on that piece of paper so that they can understand more readily what I'm talking about. And that's kind of the approach I'm going to take today. There's going to be a ton of slides, a ton of things to try to help illustrate what I'm talking about. So without further ado, let's move on to the next slide. So one of the things that we like to do in Sundays in July is recommend books for your spiritual edification. And this is a book that was written quite a long time ago. It's called Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. There's a second book that came out called In His Image, and it's written by Dr. Paul Brand. And I read this as a new Christian, and it was super memorable to me and impactful on me because I was a young scientist and then a young doctor. And this was a very experienced surgeon who spent pretty much a lifetime in India serving primarily leprosy patients, because he was a surgeon, and a lot of his patients had problems with their feet, problems with their hands, and he would come up with novel and previously undocumented or unthought of ways to surgically treat these patients. He also would, for instance, go into the wood shop and try to fashion special clogs that were tailor-made for that patient to prevent inflammation and pressure on their feet. And so he's quite a guy. It's a wonderful read. I would recommend that to you. I have it on electronically on Amazon Kindle. That's what I have. I loaned out my copies of it many years ago, and it kind of disappeared, so I don't have it anymore. But I love this book, so I just thought I would recommend it to you. So let's go to some spiritual points about the Lord and his creative brilliance. And the first thing we're going to talk about is Psalm 139. And Psalm 139 is a very famous psalm of David, where he talks about how God is omniscient, God is omnipresent, and he is omnipotent in his creation. And we're going to park on his all-powerful nature. So starting in verse 13, it says, "For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and intricately woven in the depths of the earth." So starting in verse 13, we get a theme that you can follow throughout, particularly the Old Testament, talking about how God formed us in the womb. And so if you want to, you can do a little word study and look up all the different places where it talks about that. And basically, the word is interesting in the Hebrew. It basically means to sort of like build a tower. So it's building, it's collecting the components necessary, and then it's building. And it has the idea to me of formation, of fashioning, you know, of making something. So how God formed our inward parts, for you wove me in my mother's womb. And I think that's a beautiful and very apt description of what happens. It's like a tapestry where God is placing specific things in specific places to create something beautiful, something perfect, which is you and me. And then verse 14, it says, "I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." And I have to a confession to you that over the years, I've read this probably hundreds of times, the years I've been a Christian, but I completely glossed over the first part of that verse. It says, "For I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." I would kind of park on the fearfully and wonderfully made part. And that struck me as a take-home for all of us to apply what we're going to learn today and be overwhelmed by God's creative, the complexity of who we are that God has created, is to remember to thank him for that. Because I'm pretty sure that you don't wake up in the morning and say, "Lord, I thank you that my heart is beating between 70 to 85 times a minute without me having to think about it." And you're probably not thinking, Lord, thank you that I'm breathing 12 to 18 times a minute without having to think about it, even though it's somewhat under conscious control. You can make yourself breathe faster if you want to. You can hold your breath if you want to. There's some control that you can exert over it. But in general, you don't have to think about it. You're not thinking about how your breakfast is being digested right now. Or maybe you are, I don't know. but most people don't. and all the other things. Your immune system is going to every nook and cranny of your body, looking for foreign invaders like bacteria, viruses, and whatnot to eliminate them without you having to think about it. So God has made us automatically able to do all these things. And, you know, as you thank him for everything else, every once in a while, thank him for that. When you wake up in the morning, you know, Lord, thank you that I have another day and that you are sustaining me. You are causing all of my inward body systems to work properly. So it's just another thing to praise him for. And then fearfully and wonderfully, fearfully has the idea of awe, humility, just like we fear God. Well, we are fearfully made because it is extremely complicated. And we're only going to scratch the surface of how complicated it is today, just enough to give you a sense of how complicated and intricate it is. But it goes a lot deeper even than what we're going to present. And so fearfully has that idea of worship and in awe of God who created all this. And then wonderfully is wonder. It's just that curiosity and that fascination and that excitement over all that God has done. And then it says, wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and intricately woven in the depths of the earth. And so looking at the left side of the slide here, we have the very first picture and portrait of my now 3-year-old granddaughter. And so she was, this would be her very first 4D ultrasound picture when she was in the third trimester. That just illustrates how fearfully and wonderfully made that we are. So there's a couple of other scriptures here. Ecclesiastes 11:5. These are just a few of those formed type of ideas, of scriptures and ideas that are out there. One is Ecclesiastes 11:5, where Solomon says, just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. And so, again, how bones are formed, we do know a lot more about that now. But at the time, it was a mystery as to how they're formed. But again, it's God that's doing the forming. Isaiah 44:24, he's speaking to Israel. He says, thus says the Lord, the Redeemer, the one who formed you from the womb. So again, that idea of forming and fashioning and guiding the formation of the bodies of those of Israel. And then the prophet Jeremiah, it says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I have appointed you a prophet to the nations. So the Lord knew Jeremiah and formed him in the womb. So in the next few minutes, so just a little biblical foundation for what we're going to study today, and just in God's glory and great creation. So for the next period of time, I'm not sure how much. In fact, I'm going to take my watch off so I look at it so I know where I'm at. Actually, no, there's a clock on the wall. That's good. Anyway, we're going to talk about some of these kind of like scientific things and hopefully gain a greater appreciation for God's glory and our capacity to worship him. So one thing is laser pointers don't work on TV sets. So I went on Amazon and I'm going old school today. So So anyway, so the next slide, as we leave my granddaughter behind, is that this is a typical slide that you might see in a scientific talk. And the presenter will say, "This is a busy slide." And you're saying, "No kidding, this is a busy slide." But the point is not so much to get everything off of it, right, by looking at it immediately, but to illustrate a point. And the point is this. When conception occurs, you have 23 chromosomes from mom, 23 chromosomes from dad, forming 46, which eventually turns out to be you. And there is a process by which a single cell becomes everything. And you know, in and of itself, that's enough to be mind-boggling, I believe. But anyway, so what happens is very soon up here, upper right for you that are on either side, when an embryo starts to be formed, it starts off as a single cell, which becomes a ball of identical cells, which then it starts to create this fluid-filled cavity that's sort of like a ball. And at one end of it is a disc called a blastocyst. And the blastocyst consists of these things are called pluripotent stem cells. Now, many of you have heard of stem cells nowadays because there's stem cell therapy for a lot of things. And so scientists and doctors are using these cells to kind of manipulate them to make new cells and new tissues and reconstitute bone marrows and things like that. So up here, this blue dot represents a pluripotent stem cell. And there are different protein factors, like all these things that are written here. Don't worry about them too much. I'm going to show a few or try to point out a few things here. But the pluripotent stem cell has the ability to turn into everything in your body. And so in the embryo, it differentiates. There are different factors here, here, and here that make it go down different directions to form different tissues within the body. So the first thing is there are things, growth hormones and whatnot, and different types of enzymes that cause it to differentiate into the first tissue I'll talk about is called ectoderm. So ectoderm's on the outside. It's like the outside layer of your body. So it forms, as you might guess, skin. But a little bit unexpected, it also forms your nervous system. So the spinal cord, the brain, and all that are all formed through the ectodermal layer of the forming baby. And scientists think they're very funny. They come up with different types of terms for things. So one of the growth hormones, somebody named Noggin, like the brain, you know, the head, you know, very funny. So Noggin. Back when I was a grad student, the only thing that existed was epidermal growth factor. That's the only one that we knew about. And so in wanting to be more updated, I looked all this stuff up. And there's a whole, as you might expect, in the last 40, 45 years, there's a whole lot more growth factors. Okay, another one, it differentiates to mesoderm. So mesoderm is kind of an intermediate layer. It forms the next layer down. So you have bone and muscle. You have all of the blood cells in the bone marrow come from mesoderm. The heart comes from mesoderm and all the blood vessels. And also like bone and muscle and all the things that connect us together, connective tissues and that are all from mesoderm. And I'm looking for another funny one of these things. Where is it? Here it is. It's way over here. It's called Sonic Hedgehog. So somebody named a growth factor Sonic Hedgehog. So I don't know if it has like a little spiky hair on the cell or whether it's just really fast. I don't really know what it is, but Sonic Hedgehog. But anyway, so mesoderm. So that's an intermediate layer. And also like platelets and all the blood cells all come from there. And then there is endoderm. And so endoderm is kind of the innermost layer. It's kind of your internal organs. So you have the intestines, the liver, the pancreas, and also the lung. And the beta cells of the pancreas also come from the endoderm. And it looks like noggin and hedgehog have something to do with this as well, these tissues differentiating. But as we will see, pretty much everything in your body, in your all the systems that develop, all come from the nucleus of the cell and DNA, which is what we're going to talk about next. But DNA is necessary to be the message, the almost like the computer hard drive that runs everything in our bodies. It tells the cells what to do, how to make things, when to do certain things, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go. So how do cells divide? So this is something that probably a lot of you studied in basic biology, and you're saying, the cobwebs are being swept away. I sort of remember this. And I sort of remember it too. But anyway, yeah, this is a long time since I thought about this stuff. Being a doctor, we just talk about, you know, how to diagnose and treat things. But anyway, how cells divide. You have a cell. We'll start down here in the left lower area of the slide. And there's a thing called the nucleus of the cell that contains the chromosomes. Chromosomes are made up of DNA and protein called histones, and that gives them structure. And what happens is when a cell is getting ready to divide, there are these things that are called centrosomes with centrioles, which are these structures here. There's usually one. Then you, as it's getting ready to divide, you get two. Meanwhile, the DNA is being replicated so that you get an exact copy of the DNA that's already there, the 46 chromosomes, 23 from mom, 23 from dad. And then the centrosomes form in here, and it's called interphase. The DNA is being replicated somewhere in here. And then you look here and you start to see these little fibers forming between those centrosomes. And you see the chromosomes here are, there are these things called sister chromatids where you have like a copy of the chromosome. And so then what happens is, that's called prophase. Then in metaphase, the centrosomes are at different poles of the cell, and the chromosomes line up down an axis in the middle. And then they get pulled by these centrosomes to different poles, these things called daughter chromosomes, and then that's anaphase. And then you get into what's called telophase, where the chromosomes get bound up again by a nuclear membrane, forms the nucleus again, and then cytokinesis, they split off, get their completely replicated cell membrane, and now you have two daughter cells exactly the same as the original cell. So that is going on. One of those things to praise God for, you got that going on in your bodies every second right now. Your skin cells, your intestinal cells, your blood cells, a lot of different things are being replicated right now, even as we speak. And there are different, I did look up, this is the basics, this is stuff I learned like many, many years ago, but there's some new complex discoveries that have been made. So there are things called cyclin-dependent kinases. And in the cell, kinases, they either contribute a phosphorus group or cleave off a phosphorus group, which is a signal to the cell to do certain things. So it can kind of switch on and switch off different things. And so there's different things that regulate the DNA replication. And there's even things that regulate and check that there's no mutations. There's things that make sure that there are certain processes that cause the chromosomes to make sure that they are properly replicated. And then also there's a checkpoint here to make sure that the right and exactly the correct number and the correct exact chromosomes go in two different directions, so you wind up with two identical cells rather than one cell that has a bunch of extra chromosomes because it got messed up and went to the wrong direction. This becomes extremely important because a lot of cancers start when there is something called aneuploidy, which means too many chromosomes. And that can happen if there's a problem with this process. So it is amazing that throughout a lifetime, for the most part, most of the time, in almost everybody, it's working perfectly. And that doesn't happen. Not everybody gets cancer. And not all cancers are caused by aneuploidy, but some of them are. So that's really important. So there are a lot of very exquisitely coded checkpoints in this whole process. So, you know, this is the kind of typical high school, you know, like simplification of the process. But in between all these steps, there's a million different things going on. There's in order to make new cell membrane, there has to be production of the components of the cell membrane. The nuclear membrane, that has to have the components have to form. all of these checkpoint kinases, they all have to be produced by the cell. And so it's this incredibly complex and exquisitely controlled process in order to have cell division. So those of you that are in high school or are going to take biology, it's really complicated. So just wanted to let you know. Okay, so let's go into more of the specifics of DNA. So this is, again, a very simplistic representation of the DNA structure. And so what you have is on the outside, you have these rails of deoxyribose. Deoxyribose is a substance that can polymerize and form almost like the rails on a ladder. And the steps on the ladder are these things called nucleotides. And so there's four different nucleotides, adenosine, thymidine, cytosine, and guanine. Two purines, two pyrimidines is what they're called. They have bonds between them. The cytosine and guanosine have three bonds that hold them together. The adenosine and the thymidine have two. And actually, this is an oversimplification because the DNA is in what's called a double helix. I'm sure you knew about that. So it twists around. It's not just a nice line. That would be very simple. It twists around a central axis. And so it's almost like a spiral staircase type of structure. And there was quite a race in the late 1950s to figure out the structure of DNA. There's a couple of scientists that got credit for it. There were different models that had to do with three different strands instead of two. They didn't know that it was a double helix. They finally figured that out, and then a couple of people, like three people, got the Nobel Prize in 1962 for figuring this out. But this structure is brilliant because it allows for a lot of different biological processes to occur somewhat flawlessly. So that's the DNA bases and how they match up. So let's find out what they do. So what they do, this is an example of what they do. And it's complicated, and I apologize to the people that are on the ends here because I'm going to mostly be pointing here. But so within the nucleus, this kind of dark purple thing here, that's the nuclear membrane, there's a thing called transcription. So you can think of it as the boss, like the DNA, is now sending out an email to the factory. Okay, you can think of it that way. So the DNA begins to unzip, and another substance called RNA or messenger RNA, it forms a complementary strand to the DNA. The only difference is the RNA has ribonucleic acid, so it's ribose rather than deoxyribose, so it's a little different. And one of the base pairs, instead of thymidine, it has another one called uracil. But otherwise, it can line up with all of the bases of the DNA. So this thing unzips, it starts to make a base pairs will pair up with the DNA. It can also go in two different directions too, so you can make different proteins kind of at the same time. The messenger RNA then goes out into the cytoplasm where it meets up with a thing called a ribosome. And a ribosome has protein and also has its own RNA. And the messenger RNA kind of sticks to and is held by the ribosome here. The ribosomes are kind of three-dimensional. They are not flat like this. And they are held in place. And then what happens is every three base pairs of the DNA and hence the messenger RNA have a thing called a codon. So it might be AUC, CG, CGA, you know, different bases are represented here, and they code for a specific amino acid, which will then allow the cell to start sticking those amino acids together to make a protein. And the whole body needs protein. So there are these things, it's called transfer RNA, that the nucleus also codes for producing this as well. But there are specific ones that bind a specific amino acid that will be turned into protein. And so each transfer RNA has a thing called an anticodon, which has different bases, three different bases that will able to bind and pair to the sequence of the messenger RNA. So it comes down here and it lands. Many years ago, I was trying to teach some folks about how this works. And at the time, the moon lander was fairly well known back then when the United States used to send astronauts to the moon. And there was a thing called a lunar lander that would come down and light on the surface of the moon. So I told them, I said, this is like the eagle has landed, is how I put it. And so anyway, the eagle is the transfer RNA. It binds here, it lands. And then a second messenger RNA or transfer RNA that has a different amino acid or maybe even the same one, depending on the sequence here, it lands next to it. There's a peptide bond and the two amino acids start to form a protein. And then this transfer RNA leaves and goes and finds another free amino acid. And this just keeps on happening, going, clicking all the way down the messenger RNA until finally you are left with a protein that has a sequence of amino acids. Proteins can be very simple or they can be very complex. There are things called enzymes in the body that are produced by this process. And an enzyme is a catalyst of a chemical reaction. A catalyst is something that is not used up in the chemical reaction, but provides a surface or an area where a chemical reaction can occur. And enzymes are so important to everything, the production of every protein, you know, everything in the body is dependent on this. And it pretty much all comes from from the DNA. So we produce proteins. So what happens to the protein after it gets produced? Well, I'm glad you asked. So the ribosomes. Ribosomes are sitting on the surface of this stuff called endoplasmic reticulum. So if you want to go home and tell your kids a new word today, that would be a fun one to have them learn. So endoplasmic reticulum. So all of the ribosomes are sitting on endoplasmic reticulum, and as they produce proteins, the proteins get placed into this area on the inside of the endoplasmic reticulum, and different things happen to the proteins there where they can be processed, cleaved, and put in a final a final state, and then they will collect on the ends of one of these things, and they will start traveling through the cytoplasm and many times fuse to the cell membrane, dumping their substance out into outside the cell where they're needed, or sometimes they stay inside the cell, depending on what's necessary. This other thing, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, we're not going to talk about. That's a totally another thing. You make steroid hormones there. So I ran into this thing the other day, and it kind of looks to me like one of those scenes from the later Star Wars movies where they're flying through a city. This looks like a city with all the lights and everything. But what this is an X-ray crystallography image of a cell, on the inside of a cell. And so it just gives us a more, it's a two-dimensional because it's flat, but you get more of kind of a feeling for how complex all that is. It's not at all like that little diagram that I put up there that's showing, oh, it's so simple. Here, you know, this is here and that is there and we can see it all. Yeah, this is a lot more complicated. So what I believe this thing is a mitochondrion. Mitochondria are like the powerhouse of the cell. They have certain enzyme systems that help us to produce a lot of energy, and they're very, very important. They actually have their own DNA, and they can divide. And like, for instance, if a person is a long-distance runner, they might have more mitochondria to produce energy than somebody who's sedentary and so on. So that's mitochondria. I think this is an endoplasmic reticulum over here. It's got different proteins that are going to the inside. You have some ribosomes on the outside. And then, but the cell isn't just a glob of jelly. It has a structure. So you see here, there are like rod-like structures here going across that give, and these things that looks almost like rebar here that different tubules that can cause the cell to have structure. And so that it's not just a blob, it definitely has structure. Up here, this looks to me, there wasn't really a label on all the stuff. I'm just kind of assuming this from what I know about histology and whatnot. This I think is called a desmosome. So this is a cell membrane. This is a cell membrane between two different cells. And these are like tethers or like staples almost that hold the two cells together so that they don't fall apart. So, because there's different parts of your body, like the skin cells and whatnot, that they need to be strong and they need to kind of hold together. So God has provided a way to hold everything together. So I thought that was really a cool picture. Okay, so here's the next thing I'm going to talk about is something that's unbelievably complex. I pulled out my old neuroanatomy book, and I started asking myself a very important question. How did you pass this class? I mean, it is all the different stuff coming off the brain and nerves and the spinal cord, and you have to memorize the different tracks going down the spinal cord and all this stuff. Like, man, how did I remember that? I'm glad I don't have to take that class again. But anyway, I will give you some highlights here. So one thing is, I was reading a little article by a neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic the other day, and he had some really fun facts about the brain that I thought I'd share with you. So one of which is, it is more efficient than any computer that exists. It is the only thing in the universe, he said, that can contemplate and self-reflect. You know, there really isn't anything else that does that, computers or anything else really, that it generates enough electricity to run a 25-watt light bulb because it's having electrical responses and sending messages all over the place all the time. It is about 2.5 degrees warmer than the rest of your body, probably because of that same reason. It's about half fat. There are these things called sphingolipids that kind of help its structure. So it tends to be a little bit jelly-like, and so God had to provide different things to help us protect our heads and our brains, which I'll talk about. It has 100,000 miles of blood vessels, which is enough to circle the Earth 4 times. So if you guys like to travel, you can think about your brain. The brain does not feel pain, surprisingly. And in fact, a lot of neurosurgeries are done while the patient's awake because as they take a tumor out, they stimulate different parts of the brain. They say, did you feel that? Did you feel this? Whatever. And the person actually can tell them, oh, yeah, I felt that. Or like, whoa, what did you just do? You know, that kind of thing. You know, if you have a headache, it's not the brain that's hurting. It's the coverings around the brain, blood vessels. They have nerves, and so if a blood vessel dilates, it can cause a pounding like a migraine. There's the meninges, which is a covering of the brain. And the brain, it actually makes new connections and new connectivity throughout your entire life. Even into old age, you can still remember stuff or memorize stuff. So it's kind of amazing. There's different parts of the brain. There's the frontal lobe. There's the occipital lobe, parietal lobe, temporal lobe. Back here is something called the cerebellum, the medulla, the pons, and then the spinal cord. And each of them has a different function in terms of like memory and emotion, the motor cortex, sensory cortex. There's a thing called Broca's speech area that helps you with your speech and speaking. The occipital cortex, which is more visual interpretation, and the lower part of the parietal lobe does that as well. Cerebellum is important in balance. If you have like a stroke of your cerebellum, you usually fall toward the side of the lesion that occurred, which is kind of interesting. And then, you know, the base of the brain. I know that about the cerebellum because many years ago, my father-in-law had a stroke, and they thought he was having vertigo, but he wasn't. He was having a stroke. And there's a sign, it's called the past pointing sign, that we check a neuro patient. And so usually what you do is you have the person, like, you know, like the drunk test you've seen on TV where the finger, nose, fingernails. Well, if a person has a cerebellar lesion, they will go, it's called past pointing, and they'll go right past the finger that you're trying to get them to go. They'll go right past it. So I went to shake hands with my father-in-law, and his hand went, whoa, right past me. I'm like, uh-oh, you better call the neurologist. I think it's more than just vertigo here. So anyway, if you cut a brain in half or make a slice of the brain, which neuroanatomists love to do, they love to do brain cuttings for some reason. But anyway, I have this slide because just to illustrate, the outside of the brain is what's called gray matter because it's gray. And it contains all of the nerve cell bodies that send connections all the way down to your toes. It communicates with the other side through something called the corpus callosum. It creates spinal fluid in here, which can leak out, and it goes around the brain to protect it. It's like water, a water bath that protects the brain. There are things called basal ganglia that are also very important in movement. There's other parts of the brain that have to do with emotion, a lot with emotion and the formation of memories, and then the ability to do pretty much everything that we do, walk, move, everything that we do. And what's interesting is the gray matter, nerve cell bodies here that send the impulses down these axons, they cross over in this area called the pons. And so the motor on this side goes to the right side and the motor on this side goes to the left side. Yeah, I mean, God didn't have to do it that way, but it's amazing that he did. And so that's kind of how the brain is set up. The gray matter is made up of all these nerve cell bodies that have these things called dendrites that communicate with all the other cells that are surrounding it, which allows it to communicate, form memories, neural networks, ability, different things to be able to move. And in a little while, I'm going to talk about the eye and the ear and how everything is kind of interconnected in the brain. The white matter are more of these, they're called myelinated axons. Some are not myelinated, like pain fibers. They're thought to be kind of slower in terms of their transmission. But if you drop a heavy rock on your big toe, you'll be saying, boy, that was fast. You know, I just say, like, ow, that really hurt, or you hit your thumb with a hammer, you immediately know it. But it's slow compared to a myelinated axon. The myelinated axon, it has these specialized cells called Schwann cells that God designed that take a impulse from the cell here, and it jumps from this thing called a node of Ranvier. As you'll notice, doctors like to name stuff after themselves, or people name stuff after a doctor. So Ranvier and French doctor, these things, it jumps from node to node. In fact, I think that's what that is. It may have another meaning, I'm not sure, but these Schwann cells, it goes boom, 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 and then it goes to the axon terminal where it communicates with another nerve through something called a synapse. So the synapse looks somewhat like this, and this is how nerves transmit information one to another. If a thing called an action potential comes on down all the way down to here, it's like an electrical impulse that goes down a nerve. When you get to the axon terminal, there is different substances like acetylcholine or dopamine that are released across this synaptic cleft, and it binds to post receptors in the receiving neuron, which then sends the impulse down to the next nerve. It's kind of like tag. You know, the neurotransmitter comes here and goes, tag, send it on, you know, you're it. And then it's interesting that this then gets retaken up again and then reused for the next impulse. So one of the things that nerves send things to is to the muscles. And so this is a classical anatomy sketch of all the different muscles. And what's amazing about this is in God's design is you have muscles that are interacting with joints, which allow us to move. And it's covering up all these different areas. There are muscles that are tiny that are inside the inner ear. There's all kinds of muscles. There's three different types of muscles. There's what's called skeletal muscle, which is like the muscles like your bicep muscle that kind of goes like this. There's cardiac muscle, which is more, instead of very linear or on a long axis, it tends to branch more, which allows the ventricles of the heart to squeeze blood out. Instead of just going straight like that, they kind of squeeze a little bit and send the blood out. So God took one particular type of thing and adapted it to the right place and the right function. So anyway, skeletal muscle. And then there's also something called smooth muscle, which doesn't have these lines like this muscle. This is the skeletal muscle. It doesn't have that, but it has like a network inside the cell that allows it to contract, and it lines, smooth muscle lines like all of our blood vessels and things like that. So it opens and closes our blood vessels very efficiently. So this is what skeletal muscle looks like on a pathology slide. It has multiple nuclei in each cell, so it's not all cells only have one nucleus. And there are different stripes here that represents different proteins that we will look at next. So if this is a muscle fiber bundle, as the nerve comes to the muscle, it transmits its information to tell the muscle to contract. It releases acetylcholine, which excites a membrane that's around the muscle to start dumping calcium in around the muscle fibers. And the calcium causes a protein called troponin to bind to a protein called actin. And that then induces the release of a phosphorus here, releasing energy, which then causes this little knobby looking thing called myosin. It has these little heads on it. And when that happens, the myosin, when the troponin binds, it allows the myosin to react with the actin, and it turns and pivots. And so it's like pulling the actin along from two different directions, which allows the muscle to contract. And so after the muscle needs to relax, the calcium gets pumped back in here and the muscle relaxes. So we have the relaxed muscle, the contracted muscle, more muscle shortens and produces tension. And it's all because these little myosin little heads are twisting and pulling it along. And there's millions of them in every muscle. So a schematic of that is when the muscle's relaxed, the area between the two actins are a certain distance apart, thing called the H zone. Histologists love to confuse medical students. They have all kinds of terms for every one of these little lines and everything, and I'm not going to try to memorize it again. I'm sorry. I had a test one time. I'm not going to do it again. But anyway, the H bone zone, and there's a thing called an I band and all this different stuff. But what happens is these are the little heads that pivot, and it pulls the actin together. And so see how the distance here is shorter, and that's kind of how it works. So it's miraculous. God is amazing. I think at the end of every slide, we could all say in unison, you know, like wheel of fortune, you know, we could all go fearfully and wonderfully made, you know, after every one of these. It's just mind-boggling how all this works. I mean, the complexity of it, I don't think I'm even giving you half of the complexity. Like biochemists and molecular geneticists and stuff look into all this stuff all the time, and I'm sure they keep discovering more and more and more controls and more complexity, and you know, it just gets crazy, mind-boggling. So organs of special sense. Those of you on the sides here, something I don't need to point to, so you get the same thing as the middle section. So Proverbs 20:12, it says, "The hearing ear and the seeing eye, Yahweh has made both of them." So we're going to talk of organs of special sense. We're going to talk about two of the four. So you've got hearing, seeing, smell, and taste. So we're not going to talk about smell and taste for the sake of time. So here's the eye. This boggles my mind almost more than anything else that we can see. So this is a cross-section of the eye. You have a thing called the cornea, which is like one cell layer thick, and it has more nerve endings than any other part of the body because you need to be able to tell if even a little speck is in your eye so you can get it out of there so it doesn't damage and kind of rub against your cornea. If you happen to scratch your cornea accidentally, usually the doctor will have you patch your eye for 24 hours. The first 12 hours, the cells will divide and cover up the scratch really fast. But it hurts really bad because there's so many nerve endings there. So by the next day, hopefully you start feeling better. So the other thing that's amazing about the lens is it's clear. The cornea, it's clear. Well, what could it be made of that would make it clear? I mean, this is mind-boggling. So there is this stuff called collagen. There's different types of collagen, but it's lined up in such a way, absolutely perfectly, so this is clear, so you can see right through it. And so that comes to here. The next thing you encounter is the iris, which is what gives you your eye color. And it either constricts or relaxes depending on how much light there is. So somebody, some mean doctor shines a light in your eye.
Very bright light,
as bright as we can find. No, there's a reflex. There's a reason for that. But there's a reflex which, if it's really bright, there's a muscle there that will constrict. And if it's dark, it will relax, which allows more light in. So again, that's just an amazing adaptation that God has given us. Then the next thing you get to is the lens. The lens of the eye helps us to focus whatever we're looking at on the back of our eye, the retina, which is where all the receptors, photoreceptors are located. So it's kind of interesting. It's a biconcave lens. And so when, let's say we have a stick figure here of a person, as it goes through here, it actually gets set upside down, and the retina will recognize it and send it to your brain, but your brain turns it right side up. Unless you were standing on your head, that's a different story. But anyway, so the lens helps you to focus, and it has little muscles here, so it can either pull on it, which makes it more flat, which is more distance vision, or it can make it relaxed and have it be more rounded up, which allows you to bring things close in, and then you will still can focus close in things on the back of your retina and see them clearly. So in the back of the eye, there's a thing, it's called the fovea centralis. This is the most clear vision that you have. So when you're looking right at something, your eyes are focusing on whatever you're looking at on the fovea centralis. There are photoreceptor cells called rods and cones that transmit the image to the brain through this thing called the optic nerve. The optic nerve is interesting. It comes directly from the brain. It has the same coverings on it that the brain has. Outside of the retina, which covers the whole back of the eye, it's not just like a little thin membrane. It covers the whole back of the eye. And on the more outskirts, you have more of the rods, and in the central vision, you have more of the cones. The cones are more sensitive. Another thing to make things even more complicated is we have strap-like muscles that attach to our eyeballs that allow us to look around. And for the most part, we have conjugate gaze, which means both of your retinas are focusing on the same thing at the same time, which allows you to have binocular vision, you know, which is different than, and allows you to have depth perception, which is different than when you close one eye, things are different. And also another thing that should be mentioned is a thing called the vitreous body. This thing in here, it's a jelly-like substance that gives your eye substance. So it gives it a little bit of form, just the right amount of tension and pressure so that it's like a ball that can move in different directions. But you've also got these strap muscles which help your eyes to move in an amazing way. So looking at the retina close up, these are the photoreceptors here. There's things called cones and rods. The cones are more sensitive vision and color vision, and they're more in the fovea here. The rods are more dim vision, and when it's darker out, it helps you to be able to make things out in more like night vision. We also have a thing called a blind spot, which is right here, which is where all the nerves that are coming from all these photoreceptors, all the way to the retina, are going all the way to the brain, and where the nerve comes in, there's no photoreceptors there, so you can't see there. And what doctors will do a lot of times, if a doctor is looking into your eyes with an ophthalmoscope or the optometrist or whatever, they are looking at this optic nerve area. It should look like a frisbee, or a dinner plate. It should have sharp edges. If it does not, it could mean that there's more pressure inside your brain than there should be, and it's pressing, it's sending the fluid here and making it bulge, and that's bad, and then the doctor will get excited and do things for you. So when we're seeing, let's say there's an image over here to the left. The image will come into this part of the retina on this, the left eye, and this part of the retina, the right eye. And then it has to kind of tell the brain that it's a single object over here. So what happens? It comes over here and whoa, it crosses over and comes over here and forms an optic radiation, it's called. Same thing with the opposite side. It crosses over in a thing called the optic chiasm, which is in the base of the brain. It then goes to mostly the occipital cortex or visual cortex, where all the information that was provided from the photoreceptors are interpreted by the brain in terms of memory and of visual things, of recognition, of all kinds of things like that. So like you have a little baby and he starts to recognize mommy and his eyes start to mature. And he sees mommy and has a big smile because he remembers mommy, and it's stored in his brain and he has recognition. So to me, this is one of the most convincing things for the Lord's creating us is the eye. It's just it's too exquisitely designed for me to be happening by some kind of random process. So another thing I just wanted to mention is when Jesus healed somebody that was blind, he had to basically recreate the eye. So was it a problem with the cornea? Was it a problem with the lens? Was it a problem with the retina? Was it a problem with this? What was it? What is causing it for that blind person? Well, you know, there weren't any ophthalmologists in those days. So if Jesus healed somebody, basically he created everything, we know from Colossians, and he maintains everything, but he would have had to basically recreate the eye in that moment that he healed that person. So fascinating to think about. Okay, another thing that I think is just downright amazing is hearing. So the way hearing works is this is the pinna, so in other words, your ear. The pinna collects sound waves, and the sound waves go through the outer part of the ear. The outer one-third has cartilage. The inner two-thirds is encased in bone. It's coming here, and whoop, it hits this thing in the middle ear called the tympanic membrane, which is this incredibly thin little membrane that vibrates based on the loudness and the tone of the sound that's coming down. So you have wave energy, sound wave energy. This starts vibrating, and it sends energy, mechanical energy, to three little bones that are in the middle ear called the malleus, incus, and stapes. The stapes is named because it looks like a horse's stirrup. That's why they named it that. And it sits on this thing called an oval window, and it starts to vibrate. So when it vibrates, it communicates with a structure that's known as the cochlea. The cochlea is, it looks like a snail shell, but it's pretty much almost like a long tube that kind of folds up upon itself. And the sound wave energy becomes mechanical energy. That then is, there's a vibration here, it turns into fluid energy. So there's fluid waves now that are going down the cochlea. The cochlea has millions of little nerve endings in it that have little hair cells, and those hair cells get bent depending on the amplitude of the fluid that's going by, how tall they are, which would be loudness, and the characteristics of them, which would give you discrimination between a siren going by, a baby crying in the back of the worship center, the voice of the pastor, the French horn, you know, whatever the sounds are, it allows you to discriminate all the complexity of all those sounds all at once, and then it communicates all of that through the acoustic nerve to the brain. Also associated with this is something called the semicircular canals or the vestibular system, which also helps you to maintain balance. If there's little crystals here, if one of those crystals falls into the posterior semicircular canal, it stimulates the nerves there, and you start feeling like the room spinning around, and that's called vertigo. Some of you may have had that before. But anyway, we try to get you to move your head in such a way that the crystals fall out of these little semicircular canals. But the vestibular nerve also travels with the cochlear nerve to the brain where sound is processed and remembered. And let's say it together. Fearfully and wonderfully made, yeah. So let's go on to from the muscles need something to attach to. There was an old Gary Larson cartoon, and it was a bunch of chickens flopping around in their chicken yard, and it said boneless chicken farm because they just had muscle and they're flopping around. That's one of my favorites of his. But anyway, so we have bones. We have 206 of them. You all have 206 bones. You were born with more, but they all kind of, a lot of them fused and did different things to become 206. The bones are light. The bones are very strong. The bones allow us to move. This is kind of a jaunty skeleton. He's got his foot kind of like turned over. It's contemplating the skull, so we get a helmet that protects our brains. We can chew. We can. We have a thing called the sternum that helps protect our heart. We have something called the scapula, which allows our arm to be attached to the thorax. It's interesting. The only place that your arm is truly attached to your chest wall is here at the sternum. Everything else is due to muscles and ligaments and stuff. You've got a spine that, as we are vertical walkers, lasts us a lifetime. Unfortunately, sometimes these discs in between get smushed and we have back pain. There's bone marrow, which as we become adults, there's less and less of it, but it does occur in the sternum and in the iliac crest here. This is the femur bone. This is the largest bone in the body, and it helps support us and, you know, forms the knee, you know, from the, you know, the tibia and fibula. So that's a bone. So what does a bone look like? Like, Solomon didn't know how bones were formed, but here's what bones look like. So histologists have figured all this out. So in long bones, there are these things that are these cylindrical units called the osteon, and they have these things called osteocytes that produce a protein that gets calcium and other minerals involved that give it hardness. The protein makes it have just a little bit of flexibility so that we don't, when we get hit, you know, we don't just crumble like dropping a glass on the ground. There are blood vessels involved in bone. Bone is a very actively metabolic tissue. There's arteries and veins that go to the inner part of the bone. And there are other cells called osteoclasts that are breaking bone down. Osteocytes are building bones up. And it's really interesting that bones are not static. Your bones are being reproduced all the time. And in fact, when you're young, I think it's like every 8 years you get a new set of bones. Not all at once, otherwise you'd be like that boneless chicken farm. But it's slowly reproduced in us. As we get older, there's less bone turnover. That's why there's this thing called osteoporosis, where we have thinner bones because we don't get as much good bone turnover. So let's see. Oh, I'm way far ahead here. Okay, so one of the things that boggles my mind more than anything else, well, maybe not anything else, but boggles my mind, is how we can heal fractures. So you can go from there to there. So it's healed. So if you get support of that bone, what happens is you saw those blood vessels that are in the bone that I showed you the last slide. Bleeding occurs. It kind of, and swelling, and it kind of causes almost like a splint to that bone. And then the osteocytes and new blood vessels and all that start to grow toward the two sides, start growing to the middle. Ultimately, over the course of months, everything, all the stuff that was the blood vessels and the clot and all that stuff gets removed. The new bone gets formed, and ultimately you're left with a healed bone. So God has blessed us with that. I just think it's just an amazing, amazing thing that makes us say we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Okay, now the last thing, we got a few more minutes. I'm going to go through the lightning round. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to just bring out little facts about parts of the body, not specific large explanations, but just like boom, boom, boom. So just talking about breathing, the lungs, they have this thing called a trachea, which then gives way to two main stem bronchi. And just like tree limbs, they start getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until you get a thing called a bronchiole, which then enters into something called an alveolar air sac. And so gas exchange occurs at this point. There's capillaries around here. And carbon dioxide goes in, oxygen comes into the body, carbon dioxide goes out of the body and gets exhaled. But these cells are these alveoli are lined by these very tiny thin cells called type 1 alveolar cells. But I don't want to talk about them. I want to talk about the type 2 alveolar cell. God designed this in an amazing way. So when you have an alveolar sac that needs to stay open so that air can come in and out and gases can exchange. The type 2 alveolar cell makes something called dipalmitylphosphatidylcholine. So again, teach that to your kids. No, I'm just kidding. But that's what it is. It's this special kind of like waxy lipid that prevents surface tension in water that either you're breathing in through humidity, or there's a certain amount of humidity that's caused by the blood themselves because they're liquid. So what this does, if there wasn't for the type 2 pneumocyte, all of the alveoli would collapse because of surface tension, because water tends to stick to itself. And you've seen water bead up on the hood of a car, right? It kind of seeks itself and forms these beads. Well, it would do the same thing here and collapse the alveoli. So if it was not for the type 2 pneumocyte producing this surfactant, it's called, which is like almost like a cellophane-like substance, which allows it, the water doesn't stick to itself, keeps it open, we can breathe. Hallelujah. So anyway, so that's just one thing. The type 2 pneumocyte, God put it there for a specific reason, and it really helps us. Otherwise, we'd be in big trouble with our breathing. Okay, so the next thing, the heart, there's a gazillion things you could say about the heart, but what I'm going to say is one thing that helps the heart to function, and that is up in the right atrium of the heart, there is some nervous tissue that you get fairly early on in your embryologic life. It's called the SA node. It stands for sinoatrial node. And the sinoatrial node is the pacemaker of the heart. And it starts very soon after you're born. Before, as you are conceived. So you start to have cardiac cells that get differentiated. Remember, we talked about how a single cell becomes special cells. And there are these cardiac cells that start contracting that you can see even before the heart's formed. It's really amazing. But there is electrical tissue here, the SA node, that is kind of like in the Olympics, they have those rowing boats that row, they call them crew. And there's a guy with a megaphone, and he's telling them when to pull the oar. They're going, stroke, stroke, stroke. Well, that's basically what the SA node does. It's telling your heart about, like I think I told you before, like 60 to 80 times a minute. Normally, if you're at rest, faster than that if you're exercising. But it's telling the heart to contract. And so it keeps going from early on in embryologic life all the way until the day that you give your last breath and your last heartbeat and you die and go to, Lord willing, go to heaven. So that's an amazing thing. But if that's all there was, we would be in trouble because the atria contract and push blood into the ventricle. The ventricles need to relax in between beats to allow them to fill with blood for the next beat. So God put this other thing down here in the intraventricular septum called the AV node. And when the SA node contracts, it sends an impulse to both of the atria to contract and send blood to the ventricles. And so what happens is there's a slight pause because of the AV node, which allows the ventricles to fully fill with blood. And then they contract. There's like a little pause there. It kind of stops it for just a millisecond, and then it fires, and then it allows the ventricle to fire. If that wasn't there, it would be chaos. Blood would be trying to go into the ventricle, and the ventricle is firing, and you really wouldn't be able to fill your ventricles very well with blood and not have normal heart function. So again, fearfully and wonderfully made. Okay, so another thing in the lightning round. This is incredibly complex. It's your GI system, but the only thing I wanted to bring out is that there are nerves around all of the organs, like your esophagus, your stomach, your duodenum, your small intestine, your large intestine. There's nerves all along there that scientists have called the second brain, that there are so many nerve endings there that cause the intestinal tract muscle to be able to massage things that you eat through your intestinal tract. So there's tons of nerves there. So yeah, it's an amazing thing. There's tons of nerves in your intestinal tract. And in fact, you look at the Hebrew mind, They would say that I love you with all my guts, right, or my intestines. You feel it, things in your stomach, even though we say the heart. But yeah, it would be kind of weird and Hallmark at Valentine's Day if we if we did that differently. But anyway, yeah, it's that's why you feel it in your guts, is because there's intestines when you're upset or whatever, you feel it there because there's so many nerves. Okay, so we're almost done. So this is these are blood cells. You need these to live. There are things called platelets that are produced in your bone marrow that help you plug up when you cut yourself. It plugs up the leaking of your blood vessels. Erythrocytes. This is an amazing cell. It's a biconcave disc, sort of like a checker, and its membrane is fairly miraculous. It is very deformable, which means it can twist and turn in different directions without popping. There's a whole branch of science called rheology that studies deformability of things. And so red blood cells can actually squeeze down into tiny little capillaries and go single file through those capillaries and be squished around and not pop because of the way their cell membrane is designed. That's amazing too. Monocytes, these things are traveling around in your bloodstream. If you have an infection or something gets into your tissues, like you injure yourself, they enter the tissues and become these things called macrophages or big eaters, and they remove damaged tissue and also help help your immune system. Basophils, these are really annoying cells to some people because they're full of histamine. And sometimes they enter into tissues, and people that are allergic, they will dump histamine into their nose and they get itchy eyes, and they can get asthma and all kind of stuff because of basophils. Eosinophils have to do with immunity against different types of parasites. So if you have a parasitic infection, a lot of times they'll be higher in your bloodstream. Lymphocytes are really important for your immune system against viruses and also sometimes tumors. And neutrophils, these are the ones that move around in your bloodstream. If there's an infection, they will home in there and eat up bacteria. They have different enzymes in the inside of them that break down and kill bacteria. Lymphocytes are really, really amazing. Maybe next year we will do Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, the sequel. And maybe we'll do another one and I can talk about the immune system and how we make antibodies that have these hypervariable regions against all the different types of stuff that you've been exposed to that give you memory so that you're not constantly getting the same diseases over and over and over again. Okay, almost done here. So this is, I'm going to just talk about these cells here. So this is the kidney. The kidney actually is kind of a blood hog because we need to filter our blood. And so that gets about 25% of every time your heart beats, it goes to the kidneys. And so there's a type of little arteriole that then becomes capillaries that goes in. And there's all these capillaries in the middle of this thing called the glomerulus. And then it comes out the red blood cells come out the other side. So going in, there are these cells that line the inside of this thing called Bowman's capsule that's around each of the glomeruli, and it's going to receive the stuff that's filtered out, goes down the kidney, kidney processes all the stuff, eventually out the other end comes urine. But there are these things called podocytes, and I think podocytes are amazingly cool. They sit on the top of all these blood vessels, and if you look in an electron micrograph of their little foot processes covering the capillary. So if this is a capillary down below, capillaries have this thing called a basement membrane, which is around them, this like glycoprotein and different things. It's fairly thin in this area. And you can see the endothelial cells that line the capillaries. They've got maybe kind of some sort of like holes here that allows fluid to come through. And in between all those little octopus-looking arms coming out are these little tiny membranes between the podocyte foot processes, they're called. And so stuff can pass through there into the filter part of the kidney where urine is produced and so on. So, and then we have the rest that we're not going to talk about. And so I'm going to leave you with this. John Calvin once said that the whole world is a theater for the display of the divine goodness, wisdom, justice, and power of God. And so the next time we're in big service and we sing How Great Thou Art, I'm hoping that you will recall some of the marvelous and incomparable, miraculous aspects of our physiology and what's in our human bodies, and also remember to thank God for them. So let's pray, and we'll be done. Lord, thank you so much for just your incomparable wisdom, power, might, imagination, creativity, and how you have formed us in your image. Lord, help us to not take that for granted, to praise you for it, and to be thankful that you sustain us and maintain us each and every day so that we might follow our Lord Jesus Christ and give glory to you. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay.